Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello everybody, welcome to the Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel live broadcast. Today I'm delighted to be here with John Kelly, who has recently completed a second Barclay Marathons. Absolutely incredible. How are you doing today, John?
Doing pretty well, how are you?
Yes, very good, thank you. Sunny skies out here today in the UK. So if you're new to the channel and you haven't yet watched the previous interviews that I've done with John or seen him popping up in the Ultra Running Advice series filmed at the National Running Show where we met a couple of years back, John is a super prolific ultra runner from Tennessee who grew up with the Frozen Head Barclay Marathons Mountains as his pretty much your backyard, didn't you, John?
Yeah, just right across the road there.
Yeah, and so John and his wife have 4 kids, and you're back in the US now, aren't you, John? But you recently relocated to the UK. Was that for a year or so? Was it 2 years?
I was in the UK for a bit over 3 years.
Did you get caught in COVID in the UK?
Yeah, so I hope it will forever remain the greatest irony of my life that I moved my family across an ocean with the sole intent of building a team in person at our company, and then ended up working remote for most of the time.
The irony, yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure you got to meet a few of them eventually, hopefully. But I think you had other reasons for moving to the UK. I think it was so you could annoy our other recent interviewee and Barclay hopeful Damien Hall by not liking tea and smashing all his Pennine Way records.
Well, we had a fun back and forth. You know, I got to have a lot of good adventures while I was over there and build a lot of friendships that will last long beyond my return.
Yeah, awesome. It was really fun seeing you and Damien Hall going head-to-head on the Pennine Way. He has actually got the fastest known time record on there now, so you'll have to pop back for a little holiday, won't you?
Well, he has the men's fastest time on the spine. He has not gotten the record back on the Pennine Way itself.
Oh, okay. I thought that he'd got the Pennine Way record back.
I spoke to him
lately, didn't he? Yo, he's not doing it this year. He's leaving it with you for a while. Yes. Yep.
Yeah, he had a go at it last year, but I know that he had some really tough wind and some, which, you know, I feel like it wouldn't be the Pennine Way if you didn't go out there and have some sort of rough conditions to go with. But he definitely had some strong headwinds when he gave it a go last year.
Yes. Okay. Well, we'll wait for that then. So that record is still standing with you. And then you also smashed a Wainwright's record while you were over here, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, that was a fun last trip through the Lake District just right before I headed back. That was just incredible to get to see, you know, essentially the full Lake District in one go.
Yeah.
And just have incredible support and people joining me out there along the way.
Yeah, it was. It looked amazing. Amazing few days on there. And congratulations for completing that and beating the record. And then you also completed another incredible FKT, fastest known time. But in fact, this was an only known time, isn't it? Because you just made this one up yourself. It's called the Grand Round. And can you say in a nutshell what that comprised, John?
Yeah, it's something that I put together as an idea when I found out I'd be moving to the UK and wanted to cram in as much as possible. So the three classic big fell running rounds were very appealing to me. The Bob Graham round in the Lake District, of course, and then also the Paddy Buckley round in Snowdonia and the Charlie Ramsay round in the Lochaber region there in Scotland, starting in Fort William. And I thought it sounded like good fun to do them all consecutively and ride my bike in between them. So I had a go at it not much more than a month after I first moved over there and did the first two rounds, hopped on my bike to head to Scotland and just decided that I was too far gone, too sleep deprived to safely cycle up that narrow road up into the Highlands, and so called it there and came back and had another go at it the next year and made it all the way around. Not quite in my time goal, but made it all the way around.
Yeah. Well, it even if it wasn't your time goal, it's still the fastest known time on that route. And nobody has even attempted it yet, have they? I haven't heard of any attempts on it. Have you?
So there have been a couple people that I think have looked at variations of it, which is, I mean, fantastic. The more that these sorts of crazy ideas and personal projects can spawn other crazy ideas and personal projects that really just get people fired up, that's great. But I don't believe there have been any other attempts, certainly not any completions of it, other than Mike Hartley's original completion of the three rounds, but driving between them instead of cycling between them.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's quite a tall order, so we'll wait with bated breath for anybody who wants to try and tackle that one. but so everyone who's listening can see that John's no stranger to ultra challenges, but out of everything that you do or that you dream up or that you kind of have done in the past, apart from going up against your own nemesis, the security light, and falling off that ladder, would you say that the Barclay Marathons has been the hardest challenge of all of these things that you do?
So hard is a very relative term here, and there are many different types of hard, different challenges, different types of pain from, you know, from a 5K up to these 5-day events like the Wainwrights and the Grand Round that I've done. So I would say Barclay is definitely the hardest in terms of completion. It's something where you're either going to finish or you're going to fail. And most of these other things that I've done, there's a much more forgiving spectrum in terms of how you finish. You know, maybe I could have done the Pennine Way a bit faster. Maybe I could have done it a bit slower. But either in any of those cases, I was going to finish. So Barclay just provides a much more harsh, unforgiving cutoff there where you're kind of constantly up against the clock and being able to get around and get that done. And we see that with its intended and actual 1% finishing rate.
Yeah, and because three people finished this last year, maybe do you think Laz will make it harder next year?
That's what everyone assumes. I'm not very convinced that he'll make it much harder. I think maybe a little bit, but if you look at what happened this year, I mean, it was very good conditions. It was a very good start time. You had myself, who has finished before. Carl has been out there for a number of years, and gotten progressively better until his finish this year. And it shouldn't get to a situation where you have to have perfect conditions and a perfect start time in order to finish. So I think that most likely next year it might be just a little bit harder, with maybe a worse starting time and more normal conditions. And so that'll kind of balance out the difficulty in itself without making it impossible, which is not something that he wants to do.
Yes, yeah. And because you've done it 6 times, is that right now?
Yep. I thought just 5, but no, you're right. It's 6.
With this year, yeah. And so how does it compare that first time to the second time that you did it? I'm interested to know, was it a similar feeling when you crossed that finish line, well, the yellow gate the second time, or did the first time just really trump everything?
It was very different for a few reasons. One was the different feeling of a second time versus a first time, and the other was the mental state that I was in. Well, and then also very different conditions. So the first time, I was in rough shape. We had very bad conditions. It was cold and wet and foggy and rainy on the last loop. I was pretty far gone as far as sleep deprivation goes. I was struggling to stay awake just to get down the easy trail to the finish. And so it was basically just a tunnel vision focus on getting to the gate and touching it, lest I forget where I was and what I was doing and wander off somewhere and or take a nap and not finish. This time we had a beautiful day on the last loop. I was fully coherent and got to enjoy that and appreciate it and kind of take it in as I finished. So that was a great thing to be able to have those sorts of moments that I missed out on the first finish. But of course, the kind of, I think, level of personal achievement and satisfaction going from 0 to 1 is higher than it is going from 1 to 2. So it was just, this time around was great to join a group of just Jared and Brett Mounty, who have finished more than once, and to, you know, proved to myself the first time wasn't a fluke, but it's great to be able to see also really and Carl and those guys get a first finish, which is just an incredible experience and achievement for them.
Yeah, it certainly looks like an amazing year to be doing the Barclays, because Jasmine and Damien also had really good times on the course as well this year. So very exciting to see what they can do in future years. And we'll ask you about your future plans at the end of the interview. But I just wanted to sort of wind it back really and ask you when you first found out about the Barclays and when did you first become interested? Because as a race that gets held annually in your backyard, how did you just stumble across it one day, or how did you find out about it?
We kind of knew there were these people that came out once a year and ran around the park. We didn't know much about it beyond that. Running of any sort isn't a big thing in that area. I mean, the local high school doesn't even have a track team or cross country team or any of that, which in the U.S. that's very commonplace. That was actually one thing. In the U.K. I struggled to find a track when I wanted one, whereas in the U.S. pretty much every high school has a track at it.
Really?
But not at the local high school here. It's a very rural area, and so this whole concept of going out and running long distances was just completely foreign. I found out about it more from when I got back into long distance hiking and backpacking, which was kind of grad school time period, and I had a good friend from that who showed me an article about the Barkley Marathons and kind of read into it and said, oh, that's what these people were doing. That's cool. That would be, you know, I would love to do that, but I'll never be able to do that. So, you know, that's that at the time.
And then you got into more of the hiking and more of the running, and then you gradually thought, oh, okay, yeah, I'll give it a go. I'll write to Laz and see if he lets me in.
Yeah, so I mean, like you said, I progressed in my running and the kind of adventures out in the mountains that I was doing. And as I progressed and got better and did more things, kind of went from I can never do that to, well, maybe I could give it a go and just see what it's like if I get in, to, you know, maybe I could actually have a legitimate shot at this.
Yeah, and legitimate shot you gave it. And so to do something like the Barclays, how do you personally train for that? Do you train for the Barclays, or are you training for other ultras throughout the year and then just use that fitness at Barclays? Because very hilly, isn't it, in Frozen Head State Park?
Yeah, so it's evolved quite a bit since those initial attempts. Starting off, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have a lot of experience in ultras in general at the time. And so I found out, I got in and just kind of panicked and said, well, where are the hills? I need to go run all the hills. I mapped out my neighborhood and went and found like the tiniest little hills all over the place that I could go do repeats on. And over time, that kind of progressed to where I learned more what I was doing, what actually worked, what I needed to do, what I didn't need to do. My family was growing at the same time, so I had to be more efficient. I had less time to waste doing pointless hill repeats and other things. And for the past 4 years now, I've been working with a coach, David Roach, who also coaches Damien. The focus really has been on just maintaining fitness as high as I can throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And then in the month or two leading into Barkley, or leading into a specific event, kind of honing that fitness, targeting it towards the specific race with some more vert and technical terrain that I'm training on.
Yeah, and you mentioned your family was growing and now it's four children. How do you fit that in with balancing family life? And more particularly, like, I've only got one kid, and if he wakes up in the night at like 4 o'clock in the morning and doesn't want to go back to sleep, or wakes up at one and is up for 2 or 3 hours, how do you not just be exhausted? Because you've got four opportunities there for someone to wake in the night.
They're pretty well past that at this point, fortunately. But that part did present a bit of a challenge, as well as my job at an early stage startup, which kind of knew no bounds on the working hours and could get quite bad at times. I've been very fortunate to have the support of my wife throughout that, and kind of balancing things in terms of what we're both able to do and when one of us most needs rest, that can get the priority. But it's definitely been something that I've learned as my family has grown and as my ultra running has become more serious, and it's been very necessary to have those two things in parallel. If I went back to what I knew and what I was trying to train and do early on, and had, you know, four kids at that time, it wouldn't work. There's no way. So one of the biggest things, back when I was going into an office each day, all of my workday miles were my commute. That was it. So those were free miles as far as time goes. I wasn't spending any additional time. You know, I was working in downtown DC, and I could run or at times ride my bike down there pretty much as fast as I could take the metro.
Yeah.
I never caught on fire when I ran downtown, as opposed to the metro at times is known to do that.
Wow.
So side benefit there.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a big upside to that, isn't it?
Yeah. And then outside of that, long runs in particular, trying to make kind of family outings out of them, where I might run to a destination, you know, a park or the zoo or something else to visit. And then my family will get up and drive and meet me there, and we'll have a day out. And then any of the races that I do or other things, try to make a family event out of it. You know, we kind of made our summer family holiday last year going out to Colorado ahead of Hard Rock. And there are times definitely where, you have to make sacrifices. You have to compromise. I was planning on running a 50 miler last weekend, actually. And then my daughter had her dance recital that day, which, you know, is her one thing for that in the year. And so 50 miler was out. I might do an FKT instead, which is more on my own schedule whenever I can fit it in. So it's definitely a balancing act, and just communication and making the whole family a part of it as much as possible, rather than something separate to fit into another compartment.
Yeah, like it's not like, oh, dad's disappearing again. It's like, hey, kids, come along. This is what dad does. Yeah. It's really wonderful. I love all your Instagram. If you're not following John on Instagram, definitely give him a follow. It's at Random Forest Runner. And there's loads of lovely pictures of you out doing things with your kids, up mountains and things with them, like all four of them, like right from like it's nine now, your oldest, and the little one as well. It's just, yeah, it's really cute and it looks lovely. But I do want to just mention we have got a patron question from Hannah, who wants to know how your hand is now because of the fight with the security light and the ladder. Can you just let her know how you're doing and tell everyone what happened?
Yeah, it's pretty good. So I mean, I had a it was this wrist. It's my non-dominant wrist, which was fortunate. But I was an idiot on a ladder and set it up horribly and tried to do it myself and it slid out from under me. I slammed into the asphalt on top of the ladder from about, you know, 20, 25 feet high. Was very fortunate that I ended up with just a non-displaced fracture on my non-dominant hand, bruised ribs. I still have some scars on my shins where it just kind of left some marks, but didn't damage the bone. It was the bruised ribs that were the worst. That made it to where all I could do was just very slowly shuffle along for about a week, because just any movement at all, just, you know, felt like I was getting stabbed in the chest every step. So the wrist is good now. I can still, you know, if I try to put too much weight on it, I can still hurts a bit. I think that's more like lingering ligament damage probably than the bone itself. But Barkley was the first run I had gone on without my cast, and the wow. first time that I had used poles or sticks before the accident. So the timing worked perfectly.
Yeah, it really did. It definitely didn't hold you back with that completion of the Barclays. That's absolutely fantastic. So just before we get into the actual Barclays itself, Damien came to visit you, didn't he, in Tennessee? Did he stay with you, I think, or stay near you? And you took him out and showed him the sights and showed him the food. How was that?
Yeah, so he was staying nearby. He came out about a week early to be able to get out in Frozen Head and to learn the park, learn the terrain, and what to expect a bit. And I took that chance to go on some runs, show him around out there, and also show him some of the local fine dining and cuisine, as I just had the opportunity to spend 3 years plowing through UK delicacies. So I wanted to return the favor there.
What is it about tea that you don't like? I think Damien's very offended by this.
the kind of tea we drink around here is the kind where, you know, sugar is an ingredient, not an additive.
Okay.
You have to dump it in while it's brewing to get it super saturated.
Yeah.
Which is, you can't add the sugar afterwards. It won't dissolve enough. Damien seems to be real stuck on the iced part. That, you know, typically here, it would be sweet iced tea. And so he gets particularly stuck on the iced part, but it's the sweet part that's important. The iced, you know, I still maintain to him that if he had to deal with summers where it was, 40 degrees Celsius and 90% humidity day in and day out, that he might want a bit of ice in his tea in the afternoon as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we don't often get days like that here in the UK, but it is changing a bit here. And he said that he really enjoyed, was it the cinnamon buns? That was some kind of bun that he actually forgot to be vegan for a few minutes just whilst he sampled those.
So yeah.
You showed him the dark ways.
Well, he did try. He tried his best. But there are a few local fast food restaurants I took him to and tried to show him the best I could that what are often called fixins or side items, which there are some veggie options there and certainly some vegetarian items. But it's extremely hard to come by complete vegan options at a lot of these restaurants. I mean, a lot of U.S. Southern food comes from a time where it's a very rural and it was impoverished area. So, you know, when people were making food, that they had flour, butter, and milk, like that's it. So most Southern foods are in some way derived from those things, and it's very difficult to find local items that don't have that in some way.
Yeah, well, he really liked the Sonic cinnamon buns, I think it was.
They're just these little bites. I mean, it's sort of like sticky buns, but they're filled with frosting.
Ah, that's amazing.
I think they're filled with some sort of like cinnamony paste, and then there's frosting that you dip them in.
Wow.
He loved those, and some French toast sticks from there as well. And Sonic has great tots, the tater tots.
Yeah, so. Tater tots. They're just small square potatoes, is that right? We don't really have them in the UK.
Yeah, I mean,
we don't call them tots anyway. I think we call them sauté potatoes.
They're just shredded potatoes.
Oh,
and
shredded.
And then as they're fried, they're maybe reshaped into, you know, like a disc or a cylinder form.
Like a hash brown type thing.
Eggs, yeah, basically. It's just hash browns, but shaped into little bites instead of fully shredded. So,
yeah.
You know, that probably could have made a great Sonic commercial with after loop one. I was sitting there eating my tots, and he had some of his CineSnacks things. So missed an opportunity there.
Yeah, you should get sponsorship from them as well. And so what do you like to eat on the Barclays? Like, it must be different what you eat on the way round on the loops to what you eat in camp, where you're just trying to shovel food down, it seems like. What are your favourite things to eat there at the Barclays?
Yeah, camp's an opportunity to get some of the stuff that is just impractical to have on a loop. Liquids, larger foods, things that would get messy or spoil on a loop. Rice pudding is one of the things I brought back from the UK that I was sure to find here and have between loops. During the loops, this is something else that's evolved quite a bit, and nutrition needs and preferences are not only different between individuals, but I think they change over time for individuals. You know, my stomach's not the same that it was 10 years ago. And so I kind of have a bit come full circle where my first Barclay, I thought, oh, I'll just use gels and energy bars the whole time. They're nutrient dense. They're made for this stuff. It'll be perfect. And after 30 hours of that, my stomach just revolted and said, no more. And so I went more and more the real food route, became more and more adventurous on that. And then some things started not agreeing with my stomach and giving me some major problems out there with acid reflux and other things that, you know, you might not have to deal with when you're in your 20s. And so I've circled back a bit more to kind of a compromise between those two, but a lot of what I'll call engineered food, like athletic engineered food. I have a lot of Tailwind out there. That's pretty much nearly all of my hydration was Tailwind, and it's great to have for me the liquid and the calories and the electrolytes all in one, to where it's less that I have to keep track of once my mind is fried and there are only so many things I can keep track of at once, and that just it works really well for me personally in terms of going down easily and kind of keeping my taste buds awake. Started loops with Supernatural, something else I picked up in the UK, startup there that I affectionately refer to as baby food for adults.
It is, isn't it? I tried some. It's just it comes out and it's like poo, but it tastes good. I'm just making notes because I'm going to copy you on all this food advice.
It's a nice puree, and I had actually started using some of my kids, my daughter's baby food on some of these things, which it goes down. This was before I discovered Supernatural. It goes down well. It doesn't require a lot of water with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as compact as some of the other options out there. But then I also have recently discovered Morton.
Oh, yeah, Morton. Mountain. Yes, I love Morton gels.
Yeah, I don't know how to say it.
Morton, M-A-U. Okay. I'm not sure, though. I've just been saying Morton. I might be wrong.
but those are nice and compact, and they have a very kind of simple yet pleasant taste.
Yeah,
too.
I think so too. And they're sort of jelly-y, aren't they? They come out, yeah. They're not all squishy and sweet.
When you think of what a gel should be, to me, it's the first gel that I've had that is actually a gel.
Yeah.
As in like gelatin, whereas all the others out there are more of a syrup.
Yes, yeah, you're totally right. That's nailed it, actually.
So those are my consistent ones, and then you know, so maybe half my calories are coming from Tailwind, and then I'm kind of alternating between one of those engineered foods and a real food. So maybe like 50, 25%, 25%, and that real food will typically be like a Little Debbie cake. Some of the things that I introduced Damien to, he brought me some Jelly Babies, so I had some of those out there as well.
Do they not have Jelly Babies in the USA?
No, we have, you know, gummy bears and sort of similar things, but nothing that, that really has that same texture.
Soft. It's like soft, isn't it? Yeah. I've tried Haribo, but it's really hard to chew it after a while, isn't it? Jelly babies just melt in the mouth.
Yeah, most of what we have is more similar to the Haribo.
Yeah, like harder, sort of squishy but hard, if that makes any sense. And you just mentioned Damien there and picking up stuff from the UK again. What was it like having Damien there with you? Because you were going around with him and he said you were being really generous in showing him various things. And was that nice for you to be showing all those things to him? It must have made it a bit of a different experience.
It's definitely it's something that I enjoy now that I've kind of gone from the panicked first timer out there who didn't know what they're doing to the confident veteran gunning for the finish to now the finisher kind of playing tour guide a bit and helping other people hopefully eventually get there or get to whatever their goal might be. You know, my first time out there, I had quite a bit of help from veterans showing me around, or at least in me following them around. So it's been fun to get to experience all sides of that now.
Yeah, it really is part of the ethos, isn't it? Like the Barclay family, you're like, right, you start out, you get shown a bit, and you sort of have a mentor, a bit like at work. It's really nice, it seems.
Yeah, and I kind of told him after, you know, I got a lot of support in Penine Way and Wainwright's and Grand Round and everything in the UK, and some of that was from him. You know, all those people that supported me couldn't come over and do Barclay themselves. So I kind of had no choice but to focus all of that on him.
Yeah.
And some on Jasmine as well as much as I could, although she wasn't. And Nikki Spinks as well was out there and Tom Hollins. And so, you know, we weren't running together, but again, tried to show people around as best I could.
Yeah, it's really nice, isn't it? I just think that's lovely about the Barclays and the people that do the Barclays. And we've got a live question from Arlene, who says she noticed in one of the videos that she's seen about the Barclays that Laz puts the runners to work, like carrying logs and things. For example, Jasmine was carrying wood for a fire, Jasmine Paris. She wants to know, did Laz give you a task before the start?
Laz doesn't so much give those tasks out as just people pitch in and help. You know, the firewood shows up the day before the race and it needs to be carried up to where the fire is, and other little things here and there that need done in camp. And it's a small camp, a small group of people, and so people pitch in wherever they can, or hopefully make their crew do it in a lot of situations so they don't wear themselves out too much before the race.
Yes. Okay, so everyone just pitches in and helps. And I've got quite a random question here from Tadeusz Cantwell. He's over in Ireland. He says, this is a random question. He's noticed that many US podcasts are hosted by people who say dude and bro a lot. How representative is that of the trail running scene over where you are?
I think there are some regional variations here as well. You know, you've kind of got your East Coast runners and your Boulder people and your Flagstaff people and your California people. And so there's some variation there and definitely across some generational changes as well, but those are definitely things that, you know, if you went to a big ultra, I think particularly out west, you'd hear those quite a bit.
Yeah. Are you partial to saying dude and bro yourself at all?
I might occasionally let out a dude if it's an exclamation of some sort, like, dude, why'd you do that? Bro is not something that I think is really in my vocabulary, unless I'm saying it ironically somehow.
Yeah. Or to your actual brother, if you have one.
Yeah, I do. I think probably less likely to say it to him. Yeah.
Yeah, you could say, dude, bro, in the same sentence with him. Yeah. So Tadeusz says, as an aside, I am hoping for an Irish finisher one day, because that's where he's from.
That would be great.
Yeah, we could have fingers crossed.
I'm Irish way, if you go back like 200 years. You know.
There we go. Today we have our Irish finisher.
Kelly is a very, very Irish name.
Yes, it is. Yes, double. There you go. Today, already done. Double finisher for you. And then we have a question from Hannah. Another question from Hannah. She's the one who asked about your hand. She says, another question is foot pain. Mine really deeply hurt towards the end and afterwards of a 168-mile race last month. Does it ever get better? It's the only thing that puts me off ever trying the full summer spine race. So, yeah, have you got any tips on foot pain? Like, do your feet hurt after the Barclays?
Well, there are a lot of different types of foot pain. There's foot soreness. There's blister pain. There's, if you actually sprain your ankle or do something, it could start to hurt. There can be joint pain in your toes. I sometimes deal with that just a bit. Some of those things you learn that they're just going to come and go. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of learn to ignore them and distract yourself or focus on something else. Blisters, those can be pretty devastating. I mean, that's what ended my first Wainwright's attempt. And so that's definitely something that you need to figure out how to prevent and how to deal with. Some good socks. I try to use foot powder and some of the kind of like athletic ointment or lube. And I typically double layer my socks. I go with a pair of toe socks and then a pair of normal socks over top of those. Shoes that fit right and have appropriate level of padding. I mean, this again is getting into things that are quite individual. But it's very important to learn the difference between something that's annoying and might go away and something that's an actual injury and is going to get worse or risk long-term damage if you continue. And there are also some things in these long multi-day races like Barclay that I kind of look at and I say, great, that this will help keep me awake.
Oh, God. So the pain of the feet helps you stay awake.
If you can put a positive spin on it, a silver lining of some sort, that can mentally help sometimes.
Oh, amazing. Well, that I wasn't expecting that, but that is actually a really good positive spin to put on it. I hadn't thought of it that way. And amazingly, Hannah has just got out of her work meeting and she's just joined the live broadcast, so we're just answering her question just as she's arriving. So just leading on from there, you mentioned it helps you not to fall asleep. How do you cope with that sleep deprivation? Because you can't really train for that, can you? Do you sort of learn by experience what to expect and deal with it that way? How has it changed from all your years on the Barclays? How do you do it?
It is, like you say, you can't really train yourself to need less sleep. You can learn how your body reacts, what works best for you in terms of sleep strategy and how long to nap and when to take those tactical caffeine pills or gum or gels or whatever else. It's not something, like even if you try to to practice it, I feel like you just don't get the true experience. Yeah. as you do if you're out in a race. And I think that trying to practice it, you end up doing more harm than good.
Okay.
By depriving yourself of that sleep.
Yeah, so it is some recovery as well, isn't it, sleep?
Yeah. So it is something that I've learned a lot over the years of doing these multi-day races and other events. And, you know, I've learned my own circadian rhythm. I know that there are certain times of day where I'm going to struggle. Mm-hmm. It's inevitable. And I know when those times come, I can either preemptively take some caffeine just before that and try to coast through it. Or if it does hit me, I know that, hey, if I can just get through this little time window, then I'll magically be okay on the other side. I'll become awake and alert again. And so I just need to get myself through this tough stretch and then I'll be fine. And then otherwise learning kind of when you might need a real sleep of, you know, 1, 2, possibly even 3 hours. I generally try to, most of my naps are either 15 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour and a half, or 3 hours, or at least aiming for 3 hours. I think a couple of times on Wainwright's, I aimed for that and ended up waking up after 2 hours, which at that point you get going. Nothing's worse than trying to sleep and not falling asleep, and then you're wasting that time. And so one thing that on things like Barkley, where I don't need real sleep and might just take a couple naps, I try to just take advantage of dirt naps, you know, just doing it when it hits me on the trail, because I know that at that point in time, I can go to sleep quickly. I won't waste time trying to fall asleep or getting prepared and getting into a sleeping bag or into a bed or whatnot. I just hit the ground and I'm out, and then I get up and keep going. It's very efficient.
Yeah. And Damien said that you guys fell asleep on a book so that the next runner would wake you up. I think that's a genius idea.
Yeah, it sounded genius. Unfortunately, the next runner showed up like 30 seconds later, so we didn't actually get any sleep.
And Running Geek Girl says John Kelly is the creator of the John Kelly nap. Is that a thing? I'm not sure what she means.
I guess it could be. I've done a number of those dirt naps in some interesting locations, particularly at Barkley. You know, there's my second attempt back in 2016, I finished my fourth loop and only had I was pretty far out of it, but only had like 10 minutes left to start my fifth loop. So I started my fifth loop and made it, you know, maybe 100 feet, 200 feet up the road there, just from the gate, still within full sight of camp, and just laid down and took a nap. So that became known as Upper Kelly Camp. I don't recommend it. It's got quite the bug infestation.
Oh, well, at least everyone could see that you were safe. And maybe, you know, the clamor of camp would have woken you up so you wouldn't sleep for too long. And Arlene says, does John ever have hallucinations? I thought it was quite funny, the hallucination that wasn't a hallucination that you wrote about in your blog.
Yeah, I've never had a hallucination. I feel like I'm missing out a bit here. I've had those things that, you know, out of the corner of my eye, maybe I see a tree that looks like a person, but then I look at it and say, oh no, that's a tree.
Yeah, but I've had those when I'm not sleep deprived. I see stuff in stuff if throughout the corner of your eye, even if it's like a little bit dark or in shadow, or it's just you're just running along. So yeah.
It's I haven't had the full-on persistent hallucinations where it's kind of like, oh, I see a purple unicorn flying in front of me, and it's still there. And I know it's hallucination and it's still there. I haven't had that sort of thing. And so I feel like it'd be great to experience it just once to see what people are talking about. My problem is I can't stay awake. I can't stay on my feet. I'll start stumbling along the trail and just at risk of falling over and napping right there unwillingly. And so I was trying to do that on loop 5 this year and was trying to nap, and the alarm on my watch didn't work. And so I was trying to nap in some very uncomfortable spots so that after a brief period, my body would become more uncomfortable than it was sleepy and wake itself up so I could get going without sleeping through the end of the race. And so one of those were some muddy tire tracks that I found alongside a trail.
Comfy.
And I laid down in those and looked up and saw one of my friends, from one of my childhood friends, and he just kind of said, oh, hey there.
Hey, dude.
yeah. And he just said, oh, hey, that's a John Kelly nap if I've ever seen one. And I can't remember what exactly I said. I mumbled something about it being Barkley and loop 5, and I just needed a little nap. And he kept going with his family, and I think his wife gave me a bit of a weird look, as she should have. But it was him, his wife, and two kids. And I didn't fully process it at the time, but after the race, I was like, no. That couldn't have actually happened. I finally had a hallucination. What are the chances that, like, out on a Thursday morning in the middle of Frozen Head, one of the few places on the course where you might actually see someone, where you're not off trail in the woods, I see my childhood friend that I haven't seen or talked to in 20 years, and I recognize him immediately in my sleep-deprived state, and he just continues on as if everything's normal, seeing someone lying in muddy tire tracks in the woods trying to take a nap.
Yeah.
So I thought for sure that I'd finally had that full-on hallucination, and I tracked him down and sent him a message, and he responded with, oh, no, that was us. I knew about Barkley and your naps out there before, so thought it was best to not disturb you and let you get to it.
That's so sweet. Oh, so the hallucination wasn't a hallucination at the end. How disappointing. And so you mentioned before just about low patches, like when you're really sleep deprived. But there was another time, wasn't there, when it was kind of coming up the early hours of the morning and you were having some stomach issues, and that was a low patch as well.
Can you give me just one second? I'll be right back.
Sure. John's just gone to turn off a thing that's making a high-pitched noise. And Richard Sudworth says, no criticism of what any runner's preference is. I was just thinking Barkley must be the extreme end of terrain cruelty, and being defeated by the course rather your own fitness is interesting. Yes, that's really interesting. Definitely, there's a lot of briars out there, isn't there? And mud and steep hills, rocks, everything is designed not to let you carry on. And Antonio Cardinelli says, hello, John and Claire. And we're going to ask a couple more questions, and then I'm going to let John go to the rest of his day. But Arlene has a question about John coming back to the UK, so we'll ask him that in a minute. But he's back now. You're back. Was there a high-pitched noise? I thought I could hear a high-pitched noise.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Was it the high-pitched noise that you went to deal with?
Yes, yes.
It sounded
sorry
like
about
a kettle boiling.
No, it was an alarm going off.
Oh, okay. Someone breaking in. Leave them till later. So we're just drawing to the ending few questions of the interview. And I was just wondering Because I really enjoy reading your posts on Instagram, and you've got loads of learnings on there. But I was wondering, in the six times that you've done the Barclays, what has been your biggest learning point that you have just personally taken from doing it so many times and completing it twice? I know you've got a lot on there, but is there just one that you're like, yeah, this is a real big one?
I think that in general, and just from ultras, of kind of the lesson that things don't always get worse. It might seem like you're in a tough spot and things are continually getting tougher and headed downhill to an inevitable crash and burn. But in these sorts of long events and other long-term things, you can push through and pop back out of those. Maybe reach eventual success, maybe not what the original goal was, but there's a whole spectrum between success and failure here. It's not as binary of an outcome as many things are made out to be.
Yeah, that's a really good learning point. And I've read some stuff about why you personally do the Barclays, like basically life's too easy in the office and you like to like promote these learnings. But I really liked your quote that you said, "We do not go to the Barclay to suffer." It does seem a bit like that sometimes. "We go for the opportunity to overcome the obstacles that cause it and to push our limits towards improbable success." Do you feel like you have pushed your limits towards improbable success now, or is there still much learning and growth to be done?
There's always more that can be done in one area or the other. I mean, that's another thing I enjoy about these types of events. There's a lot of complexity to them. There's a lot of variables. There are a lot of different things that we can learn and work on. And so, you know, my relationship and my mindset and my goals as far as Barclay goes have changed over the years, and it is quite different now, but there is it's still something that I feel like I can learn from the experience, and I enjoy the experience. I still have a chance out there as well, and can help improve other people's chances. So I think there's still plenty for me to do there.
Yeah, so with that in mind, will you be trying to go back next year if Laz will have you?
Well, he has no choice in the matter.
Because you won. You get to go
back.
Yeah,
once you finish, you have a guaranteed entry.
Ah, amazing.
again, all those things, and I live... I'm back living quite close to it now, and it doubles as a trip home to see family. I don't know specifically next year. I mean, maybe, probably, but we'll just have to see how the schedule works out. If there are other things in that time frame that I really want to do that might interfere now and then, but otherwise, you know, sure.
Yeah, if there's no dance recitals, then you'll be free to go. And Arlene says, might John become a coach at some point?
I don't know. I mean, I hardly have the time to get my own training halfway right these days. But if I'm ever able to make an exit from my professional life and my actual career and move on from that, then, you know, maybe one of these days, if I have a bit more time and freedom on my hands.
Yeah, so it'd be like a different job rather than doing it as extra to what... No, I don't think... No one can fit that in.
Yeah.
And Arlene also wants to know, she says, "Hi, will you be ever going back to the UK?" She lives in the USA. "Will you be ever going back to the UK? And how about the DC area?" Which I don't actually know what that is. I'm just presuming it's a place in America.
Yeah, so, I'll hope to be back in the UK and take on some additional challenges there, some unfinished things that I never quite got done, or maybe revisit some some of my great experiences that I had. The D.C. area is Washington, D.C.
Okay, Washington, D.C. I was like, like Detroit? What's that
stand for? It's, D.C. itself is quite, it's a tiny little box shoved in between Virginia and Maryland. So the D.C. area is, or the DMV for D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. I lived there for 5 years. Before moving to the UK. And so, you know, I'll definitely revisit sometime, maybe do a race or something up there. But definitely as the kids get older, if nothing else, I want to take a trip and see some of DC sites and maybe revisit some of our old neighborhood that they might not remember much at the time.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. And are you allowed to say, like, are you wanting to keep it a secret what things that you might have planned in the UK in the future? It's no problems if you don't want to tell us, but I just wondered if we could be nosy.
Yeah, there's, still a lot of uncertainty around those. I mean, it'd be great to revisit the spine at some point in time. Maybe some variation on something like the Grand Round.
Swimming. You need to add swimming to the Grand Round. You need to do a Frog Graham round. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have. Swimming's not my thing.
I thought you were a triathlon. I thought you were a triathlete.
I was, and swimming is one of the primary reasons why I'm no longer a triathlete.
Oh, but I'm sure you'd be better than most people at swimming. Most runners aren't very good at swimming, so you could just, you know, dip a toe in.
I also came up short in all my attempts at unsupported winter rounds, which those were amazing experiences. Well, three of the four were amazing experiences. The other had some quite terrible weather.
Yeah, it's really dicey.
I mean, that's something that would be fun to give another go at and again. Relive the experience if I'm still not successful at them.
Yeah, we do get some good winters sometimes in the UK. Arlene says that she remembers you from the Miners Lady 8-hour race a few years ago. So sounds like a good race. And today she says, would John do a backyard ultra?
It's something I'd love to try at some point. I, for a while, definitely had big dog's backyard on my radar. These days that has grown tremendously, and these days WAS is quite strict on that. On you need to have a qualifier in order to do it. And to be honest, I mean those sorts of things they take a lot as far as the effort itself. The time spent on it, and then the time spent recovering, and for me, typically I can kind of do about three big things per year, mm-hmm. And so if it's something like that where I have the event itself, and then I have also a qualifier, I mean it's taking up with two out of three, it's taking up most of my year there, and at this point in time, I don't know that. That's something I want to sink that amount of time into.
Yeah.
One of these days, I'm sure, but we'll see.
Yeah, you've got to devote a whole year to stuff like that, haven't you? Like, then you're just doing one thing per year, really. But it sounds like an exciting year ahead of you. I just have some quick-fire questions before we end the chat. Are you up for a few quick-fire questions?
Sure.
You just got to give one answer. So, okay, flapjack or gels?
I mean, just flapjack, personally.
Yeah, you prefer that.
Yeah, gels are situational. Flapjacks are always good.
Excellent answer. And after a race, beer or wine?
Well, if I had to go with something along those lines, it'd be whiskey. But mostly, I'm looking for something with a bit more recovery value to it after a race.
Yeah. Oh, so whiskey's got a better recovery value, has it?
No, none of those do very much.
Oh, right, okay. So,
but if I'm going for something without that, I'd go with whiskey.
Go with whiskey, but definitely not tea, not a cup of hot tea.
No.
No, definitely not that. Okay, a Kindle or a real book? I know books are a big thing in the Barclays, so interested to see what you say here.
I don't have a lot of time for reading these days. So if anything, I'd have to take choice C and go with audiobooks.
Ah, brilliant. Yeah, listen to it on your run. I like the way you're just like totally reframing this whole quickfire questions and adding your own there. That's brilliant. Okay, so music on your run, like with headphones, or birdsong, which do you prefer?
Yeah, I don't listen to anything on my runs. That's my one time of day to kind of disconnect and not have to think about anything or not have to have any external noise and distractions coming my way.
Ah, so no audiobooks on the run then, audiobooks just doing chores and stuff.
Yeah.
I see. And art, classical art or modern art?
Not much of an art person, so what little I know about those two, I'd have to go with classical.
Okie dokie. Camping or a holiday cottage?
If it's just me, camping. If it's with my family, at this point, a cottage. As the kids get older, the switch to camping there.
Yeah, definitely easier in a holiday cottage with kids. Two more, seaside run or mountain run?
Mountain, but you know, good places in the UK, you can have both.
Yes, yeah, very, very good point. And would you plant a tree or take a race t-shirt?
Tree, for this point, you know, there's that occasional very, very special race where I might want a memento, but for the most part, definitely the tree there. So I've worked with Trees Not Tees quite a bit over the past few years, and they're a great organization.
Yes, brilliant. Well, they're all brilliant answers, John. I love the ones that you just made up as well. Thanks so much. It was really brilliant to chat to you this lunchtime. And congratulations again, obviously, on your second Barclays. And I hope your training this year goes really, really well. And hope to see you in the UK sometime and at the next Barclays, possibly.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Awesome. Thank you so much, John. And bye, everyone.
Yeah. Cheers.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.